Hi, I'm Larry Rifkin, and welcome to today's reading of USA Today for Tuesday, February the 8th. Their front page cover story is titled, The Supreme Court Shadow Docket, Alabama Redistricting Case Renews the Fight Among Justices by John Fritz from Washington. A Supreme Court ruling Monday allowing Alabama's controversial congressional map to stand exposed continued divisions among the justices over the practice of deciding major cases in a hurry on the high court's so-called shadow docket. The nation's highest court allowed Alabama's redistricting plan to stand for now, over objections from plaintiffs who asserted that state lawmakers violated the 1965 Voting Rights Act when they drew only one majority black congressional district out of seven. Alabama's population is 27% black. Lurking just below the battle over the congressional maps is a deeper dispute about how the High Court considers emergency cases. Dueling opinions Monday in the Alabama case suggested there is still discord on the court about how that expedited process works. The Alabama ruling is one more in a disconcertingly long line of cases in which this court uses its shadow docket to signal or make changes in the law without anything approaching full briefing and argument, Associate Justice Elena Kagan wrote. The case is a serious matter, which cannot properly occur without thorough consideration. Associate Justice Brett Kavanaugh dismissed the argument in a concurring opinion, calling it catchy but worn-out rhetoric that he said was off-target. The Supreme Court usually decides a case after the parties submit months' work of legal briefs and took part in hour-long oral arguments. The opinions are usually signed, so it's clear how each justice voted, and they generally involve the court parsing complex questions about how to apply the Constitution or a federal statute. Shadow docket disputes, by contrast, usually involve deciding whether to temporarily block a law while the underlying legal questions are considered by lower courts. The parties sometimes have days to file briefs, and there are generally no oral arguments. The High Court's emergency docket drew fresh criticism last fall when the justices allowed Texas's ban on abortion after 6 weeks of pregnancy to stand on a temporary basis, despite the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that established the constitutional right to abortion. The majority's decision is emblematic of too much of this court's shadow docket decision-making, which every day becomes more unreasoned, inconsistent, and impossible to defend, Kagan wrote in a dissent in September. Before that, the court unwound President Joe Biden's eviction moratorium on the emergency docket. It blocked state COVID-19 restrictions that limited gatherings in churches and synagogues and required the federal government to keep migrants seeking asylum in Mexico. Perhaps in response to the criticism, the court has scheduled an unusual number of shadow docket cases for oral argument. The justices heard arguments in the Texas abortion case, for instance, and handed down a signed opinion in December that allowed the law to stand while lower courts considered its constitutionality. Most recently, the court moved a challenge to Biden's COVID-19 vaccine or testing mandates off the emergency docket and heard arguments in January. Days later, a divided court blocked enforcement of the requirement for large employers, but permitted a vaccine mandate for healthcare workers at facilities that receive federal funding. The emergency docket isn't new. The Supreme Court needs some way to consider emergency requests to block a lower court's ruling. Associate Justice Samuel Alito pushed back on the criticism in September, calling some of it rank nonsense. Because the court isn't considering the merits of a case, he said, it can move quicker. It's a point Kavanaugh raised repeatedly in his opinion in the Alabama case on Monday. To reiterate, he wrote, the court's stay order is not a decision on the merits. But others note that the expedited decisions do have a practical impact, in part because they can signal which way the court is heading, and in part because they can run out the clock. By the time courts can address the underlying issues, a process that can take years, the dispute often resolves itself. In the government's vaccine case, the Biden administration ultimately withdrew its mandate. The Texas abortion law, the most restrictive in the nation, remains in force. In the Alabama voting suit, a three-judge federal panel ruled last month that the state's proposed congressional districts likely violated the 1965 Voting Rights Act. The court ordered the state to try again before this year's midterm elections. By pausing that order on Monday, the Supreme Court's decision will leave those maps in place for the state's primary in May. At least. The court said it would hear arguments in the case later this year, but didn't say when. That leaves open the possibility that it won't take up the dispute until after the November general election. Top White House scientist resigns over treatment of colleagues hours after conduct called out, by Joey Garrison and Maureen Gropp in USA Today from Washington. A top White House scientist announced Monday he is resigning, hours after the administration faced repeated questions about why Dr. Eric Lander hadn't been fired over his treatment of co-workers at the Office of Science and Technology Policy. Calling himself devastated for hurting his colleagues, Landers said he can no longer be effective in his role. The work of this office is far too important to be hindered, Lander wrote in his resignation letter. Lander said he will leave by February 18th, not immediately, in order to permit an orderly transfer. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said President Joe Biden accepted the resignation with gratitude for Lander's work on the pandemic, the cancer moonshot, climate change, and other top priorities. He knows that Dr. Lander will continue to make important contributions to the scientific community in the years ahead, she said. Hours earlier, reporters reportedly and pushed Psaki during the daily White House news conference to explain why Lander had not been fired despite Biden's zero-tolerance pledge on staff conduct. During the briefing, Psaki had said senior White House officials conveyed directly to Lander that his behavior was inappropriate and that corrective actions were needed. A workplace complaint last year prompted an internal review that found evidence Lander, director of the Office of Science and Technology Policy and science advisor to Biden, bullied staffers and treated them disrespectfully. On the first day of his administration, Biden directed his political appointees to treat everyone with dignity and respect and warned that if they don't, I will fire you on the spot. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said a full, thorough investigation into the allegations occurred as a result of Biden's safe and respectful workplace policy. The president has been crystal clear with all of us about his high expectations of how he and his staff should be creating a respectful work environment, said Psaki, who defended the administration's vetting of Lander before his nomination. Our objective is, of course, to prevent any of this behavior from happening again. Lander described his office behavior, which he said was at times challenging and criticizing, as the result of pushing his colleagues to achieve the most ambitious goals that this agency has ever attempted. But it is clear the things I said and the way I said them crossed the line at times into being disrespectful and demeaning to both men and women. That was never my intention, he wrote in his resignation letter. Nonetheless, it is my fault and my responsibility. I will take this lesson forward. Politico first reported the allegations against Lander, whose position was elevated to cabinet rank by Biden. His role has taken on greater prominence as the president pursues a cancer moonshot program to use federal resources to cut the nation's cancer death rate in half over the next 25 years. Nothing about his behavior is acceptable to anyone here at all. Quite the opposite. Let me be clear about that, Psaki said after several reporters pressed her about Biden not following through on his workplace pledge to fire employees who disrespect others. But there is now a process in place that was not in place at the time to evaluate and determine what next steps should be taken. The White House said that the review did not find credible evidence of gender-based discrimination, and that the reassignment of the staffer who filed the original complaint was deemed appropriate. In an email Friday to his staff reported by Politico, Lander apologized and said he realized his conduct reflects poorly on this administration. It's my responsibility to set a respectful tone for our community. It's clear that I've not lived up to this responsibility, Lander wrote in the email. This is not only wrong, but also inconsistent with our safe and respectful workplace policy. It is never acceptable for me to speak that way. I am deeply sorry for my conduct. I especially want to apologize to those of you who I treated poorly or were present at the time. The founding director of the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard. Lander is a mathematician and molecular biologist. He was the lead author of the first paper announcing the details of the human genome, the Book of Life. His confirmation to his role in the Biden administration was delayed for months as senators sought more information about meetings he had with Jeffrey Epstein, a disgraced financier who was charged with sex trafficking before his suicide in prison in 2019. Lander also was criticized for downplaying the contributions of two Nobel Prize-winning female scientists to gene editing technology. At his confirmation hearing last year, Lander apologized for a 2016 article he wrote that minimized the work of the female scientists. At the hearing, he also called Epstein an abhorrent individual. Lander said he understated the importance of those key advances by biochemists Emmanuel Charpentier and Jennifer Doudna. The two were later awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Black America's health is in crisis. Hope and healing lie in support, systemic change. A fifth of Black Americans is considered in fair or poor health, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, by Aliyah Dastiger in USA Today. Anika Nela's 80-year-old husband died last autumn, a loss so profound it's still difficult for her to comprehend. David Lewis Thomas was a Black man, a fact essential to understanding his life as well as his death. His life in Holyoke, Massachusetts was active and full, and he cared for himself the way so many Black people do, by avoiding formal medical care. I could count on one hand the number of times he went to a doctor's office if something wasn't right with his body, Nela said. He cared for his body on his own, piecing together information he heard from those he trusted the most. When Thomas got sick, Nela became his voice. She became overly friendly with white men in white coats. It's how she attempted to distinguish her husband from every other Black body, to prevent her husband from becoming just another statistic. Thomas was diagnosed with bone cancer, but he was skeptical of the largely white medical establishment and decided to take a holistic approach instead. Even the naturopath, a white woman, was a disappointment, not because she couldn't heal him, but because it seemed she barely cared, didn't check in or follow up, didn't understand the history of harm between the medical community and the Black community or what was required to mend it. In every area of health, physical, psychological, financial, and social, Black communities are worse off than their white counterparts in the United States. A fifth of Black Americans is considered in fair or poor health, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Black Americans cope with persistent racism, carry intergenerational trauma, are more likely to live in poverty, experience structural inequities in healthcare, and in the U.S. have experienced among the highest death tolls from COVID-19. Black Americans ages 18 to 49 are 2 times as likely to die from heart disease than white Americans, and Black Americans ages 35 to 64 are 50% more likely to have high blood pressure, according to the CDC. Black women are 3 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. Black women and girls experience disproportionate rates of sexual violence. Black Americans are also less likely than white Americans to use primary care and to seek therapy. When they do seek help, they report that physicians minimize their concerns. By the time many Black people walk into a doctor's office or a hospital, they are already in crisis. African Americans are used to tolerating a lot. We handle a lot of stress, intergenerational stress, historical stress, still trauma from slavery, such that we don't always know when it's time to ask for help, said Dr. Paula Pau, a professor of psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh. A lot of times we get to health care and it's too late. There's a long history of the medical system abusing and exploiting Black bodies. Dead African Americans pulled from graves for scientific study, Black women sterilized without their consent, and the notorious Tuskegee syphilis experiment. The consequences of that abuse ripple today and are particularly striking during the pandemic. A 2020 USA Today investigation revealed how racist policies of the past and the present are fueling high COVID-19 deaths in communities of color. But a history of mistrust between Black Americans and the medical community also means they are among those most skeptical of getting a COVID-19 vaccine. Black Americans consistently report feeling they are treated differently by healthcare professionals because of their race. A 2011 paper published in Clinical Orthopedics and Related Research found racial ethnic minorities consistently received less adequate treatment for acute and chronic pain than non-Hispanic whites, even after controlling for age and gender. Only 5% of active physicians are Black, according to the Association of American Medical Colleges, and only 4% of psychologists in the U.S. workforce are Black, according to the American Psychological Association. Mistrust erodes the ability to appropriately get basic needs met, often manifesting in delays in seeking and getting care, resulting in compounding neglect, which has a significant negative impact on physical, psychological, and spiritual health, said Dr. Alicia Moreland Kapua, director of the McLean Hospital's Institute for Trauma-Informed Systems Change in Massachusetts. Moreland Kapua said the onus is on the white medical professional to create safer conditions for Black patients to participate in care, which includes a willingness on the part of white doctors to inquire about, acknowledge, and consider historical trauma and harm, and a willingness to create thoughtful treatment plans that accommodate that history. Black Americans are less likely to seek formal medical care and are also less likely to receive adequate treatment when they do, experts say. This is particularly dangerous for Black Americans because they are living under chronic stress, which Moreland Kapua said humans were not designed to do long term. It's not surprising that you would see historically and chronically marginalized communities at more risk and dying at higher rates, she said. When we are having these conversations about Black health and wellness, we cannot have them independent of the very real reality that there are structural things that have to improve in parallel. When you look at the conditions in Black communities in particular, think about the things that would leave someone stressed: uncertainty, inability to cover bills, to meet basic needs, not being able to own a home, to have a job with a living wage, Moreland Kapua said. You have folks continuing to live in impoverished conditions while also dealing with a very real physical fear of being able to exist in a community, in a neighborhood, in a home, in a church, in a park. Moreland Kapua said Black health is directly tied to poor socioeconomic conditions, which create environments so stressful that they can disrupt almost all of the body's processes. Chronic stress increases people's risk for coronary vascular disease, obesity, diabetes, depression, and autoimmune disorders. Racism is also associated with a host of psychological consequences, including depression, anxiety, and other serious, sometimes debilitating mental conditions, including post-traumatic stress disorder and substance abuse disorders. Experts say challenges for Black health begin early. One of the greatest predictors of poor long-term health is adverse experiences in childhood, and Pau said Black children are especially vulnerable. Adverse childhood experiences are potentially traumatic and can include abuse and neglect, family disruptions, exposure to violence, poverty, and living with an adult with mental illness. These experiences can create toxic stress, which is severe, chronic, and damaging to a child's development. When a child experiences early, significant adversity or trauma, and there's no adult in his or her life that helps to buffer that, you see changes in their brain, Pau said. Individuals who experience toxic stress over the lifespan are more likely to engage in risky health behavior. There's more disease. There's more morbidity, and subsequently earlier mortality, Pau said. Pau said Black families and parents in particular need increased support without judgment. Parents need tools to protect their children from toxic stress and more resources to help families move beyond basic survival. Christine Brennan in USA Today opinion: Nathan Chen skates a majestic short program, gets in position to win Olympic gold from Beijing. Nathan Chen's four-year quest now has less than 48 hours to go. With a massive fist pump following some of the most beautiful jumps ever landed under the unforgiving spotlight of the Olympic Games, Chen exorcised the demons from Olympic short programs, passed to skate a world record-breaking men's short, and put himself in position to win the gold medal in Thursday's long program. Chen, 22, received more points from the judges than any man ever has, 113.97, for his soaring quadruple jumps and exquisite artistry to La Boheme, to take an almost 6-point lead over his closest challenger, Japanese 18-year-old Yuma Kabayama, who is finished with 108.12 points. The competition is not over by any means, but this was exactly the start Chen had been dreaming about since his disastrous 17th place performance in the short program as a medal hopeful at the 2018 Winter Olympics. That awful skate has driven him to 3 world championships and 4 more national titles, but it was here at the Olympic Games that Chen knew he would need to meet the moment. And when he did, when he was about as perfect as a skater can be, for 2 minutes and 45 seconds, the normally mild manner Yale student did something he almost never does. He punched the air, and he punched it really hard. I almost never do stuff like that, so I was like, why'd I do that? Chen said not long after he skated. I guess it was indicative of just how I felt in that moment. Very happy. I kind of broke character a little bit there, but just really happy. I have no idea what came over me. Local governments are more vulnerable to cyber attacks than ever before. DHS wants mayors to step up. From Washington by Josh Meyer. Cyber attacks against the machinery that runs America are increasing by the day. And the nation's top civilian cybersecurity official is calling in the cavalry, America's mayors, to form a front line of the U.S. defense. Jen Easterly, who heads the Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, says ransomware and other digital threats have made local governments around the nation vulnerable as never before. Water treatment plants, hospitals, police departments, and even the automated systems that run entire cities have been hit by hackers, at times with devastating consequences. In response, Easterly has mapped out a battle plan for fighting back. One of her first moves was to tap Austin, Texas Mayor Steve Adler, long considered an innovative, technology-savvy civic leader, to be her on-the-ground field commander. In an exclusive interview with USA Today, Easterly and Adler said their first order of business is to convince leaders at the municipal level that they need to take ownership of the problem, given the tens of thousands of bullseye targets in their communities. And their second is to let America's mayors know that Washington, and especially CISA, has lots of new money and organizational bandwidth to help them. In Austin, as in cities across the country, I think there is great angst about cybersecurity, but no direction and no resources from the federal government as to what to do, said Adler, who chairs the U.S. Conference of Mayors Technology and Innovation Task Force. Everyone has seen the growing attacks and the growing visibility of attacks on cities and on businesses, but they don't really know what to do, Adler said of his fellow mayors. And from a local government standpoint, they really don't have the resources to apply against the challenge. As a chief evangelist for President Joe Biden's campaign for improved cybersecurity defenses, Easterly hatched the campaign to convince local and state governments to batten down their hatches soon after her Senate confirmation in July. It's not just criminal cyber gangs that are targeting this soft underbelly of the U.S. critical infrastructure, she says. Increasingly, it is also nation-states like Russia, China, and Iran that seek to harm the United States. As ransomware has made clear, everyone is a target, and state and local governments face the full panoply of threats that the federal government does, from hostile nation-state actors to cyber criminals and everything in between, said Frank Cifolo, a former White House cyber and homeland security official. And to the extent that the federal government is effectively outgunned and outmatched in this fight, the state and local level are all the more so. Easterly, a former top national security agency official, said cyber villains clearly have taken notice of the chronic lack of resources and training at the local government level and are probing relentlessly for ways into their systems. Well, that's it for today's reading of USA Today. I've been reading from their Tuesday, February 8 issue. If you have any questions about the articles I've read, call the Chris Listener line. That number is 860-727-9579. I'm Larry Rifkin. So long, until next time.